right, it's me, and I want to thank everyone at the Oasis Podcast, as you were.
Podcast, the ultimate guide to Oasis. Hope you guys are okay. And yeah, it's almost the end of July. What is going on with this year? It's just a bit mad, isn't it? Anyway, we've got a cool episode for you today. Strap yourselves in. It's John Robb from Loudon War and from the bands The Membranes and Goldblade. And the guy can talk. He's a brilliant guest. Talks at like 100 miles an hour. Fires in so many stories. I was sort of just trying to cling onto his coattails, asking the occasional question, but I didn't need to because it was all brilliant stuff, and I hope you really, really enjoy it. Before we get to that, a couple of bits of news. First off, sad news. Today it was announced that Denise Johnson has died. Most famous in our world for singing on Screamadelica, so she sings the lead vocal on Come Together and Don't Fight It. So yeah, what a brilliant singer she was. Did her own solo stuff as well and sung with so many great artists over the years. And I just had to check whether she did stuff with Oasis. I wasn't sure if she'd been on maybe Standing on the Shoulders, but no, that wasn't her. But I did find that she covered Cast No Shadow live for a BBC thing a couple of years ago. So here's Denise Johnson doing Cast No Shadow, R.I.P.
Here's a thought for every man who tries to understand what's in his hands. Walks along the open road of love and life, spotting if he cares. Bound with all the weight of all the words he tried to say, chained to all the places that he never wished to stay. Bound with all the weight of all the words he tried to say, as he faced the sun, he cast no shadow.
All right, from one cover version to another, it was dropped last night. The DMAs did a cover of Gas Panic, which I thought was interesting, and I was quite excited to hear what they did with it. I've talked about the DMIs on here before. I caught them supporting Liam last year. Was it last year? I don't know what year it is anymore, what is going on. But anyway, I caught them supporting Liam. I've never been massively impressed by them. Maybe I was put off by the baseball caps. That's never a good sign for a rock and roll band. But yeah, people have always talked about them in this, like, you know, they're this amazing band, and I've listened to them and just thought, really? I can't hear it. But anyway, so I thought I'd check this out. I've done the cover of Gas Panic, you know, one of the best Oasis songs, and, you know, one that there's so much you can do with. So I thought I'd give it a listen. So here it is.
More tolerance goes to sing, crept through my curtain. Say you don't wanna see a sweat on a stormy night. Think he don't got a name, but I can't be certain. And in me he starts to confide. And my family don't seem so familiar. My enemies all know my name.
Yeah, I don't know what you think about it. I think that's really pretty dull. It's just like that same guitar just strumming out the same chords over and over again. I mean, Gas Panic is a simple song in terms of the chord structure. There's only sort of four or five chords, and three of them just keep going over and over again. It's a very straightforward song in that regard. What makes the Oasis version so good is the bass is quite busy. The bass is doing a lot. And there's so much production going on. There's so many kind of weird noises and guitar effects and keyboard effects. It's such a sort of swirling kind of storm. You know, that's the way I kind of imagine Gas Panic. Whereas, yeah, when you break it down to just the chords and the melody, it's quite straightforward. And what they've done here in just literally playing the chords on guitar and on piano, it really does show up the song to just be quite simple song. I think Tommy, the singer, his voice is great and I think he sings it beautifully. But without Liam's like raspiness, you know, what is a song about kind of this struggle of dealing with drugs? When it's Liam singing it, you get this like angry fight in his voice. Whereas Tommy's one, it's just a bit more quiet and wistful and sad. And I think that's a bit disappointing. But hey, you can never live up to Liam's vocal. No one can. And then the one bit I really thought like, oh, come on, was when it got to like the guitar solo part. Because in the original song, yeah, the guitar solo is very simple. It's just that. But it's fine because the bass is going up and down and the rest of the noises going on are amazing. Whereas here, when it's just plonking out the chords and just that simple, very simple line, it's just boring. So, yeah, so I'm still remain to be convinced by the DMX. That's quite enough of that. I hope you haven't fallen asleep. Let's wake you up. Let's have a little bit of the Membranes, and then it's going to be me talking to John Robb. I'll see you on the other side.
I guess in the late 80s, early 90s, I was like the main music press freelancer based in Manchester because I was writing for Sounds, which is long gone. It went down in 1994. But
yeah.
The great thing about Sounds was it was a freelancer's paper, so you didn't have to justify anything you ever wrote about. You know, it wasn't like the enemy is more pressure, but will this next band be big or whatever? So it Sounds, you could just go in and say, I really like this band, and they just give you a page to write about them.
Great.
So I was, that's why I managed to get on things like Nirvana and Stone Roses super early on, well, first actually in some cases, and I should have been in London. And then days London was the main music scene. He went down there, he became the main writer. But I was a bit of an anomaly really, because I was the main writer but not living in London, which nowadays living in Manchester would seem really weird because Manchester's equal media city to London.
Yeah,
but there's definitely a feeling before the Roses broke out, and this is despite Joy Division, despite the Smiths. Mm. That Manchester was some kind of weird parochial backwater that managed to fluke a couple of bands, you know.
Right.
So when the Roses came out, people in London were saying, well, we don't really know about these. How come they're doing, you know, they'll get 600 people out of Manchester. People didn't believe me. They thought I was just making it up to get a bigger piece in the paper. But the cool thing about Sounds was he just said, if you like them, do them anyway.
Great.
So because of all that, and because there's a bunch of us who just went to every gig in town, and Noel to this day calls it the Manchester 50.
I love that. I read your brilliant article and from a few years ago now, and yeah, the Manchester 50. I love that.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, it wasn't like a super hip in crowd with just music heads that would go to the Boardwalk or go to the Internationals. You see the same faces everywhere, you know, and I still know them all to this day. And so when I first was aware of him, I think it was probably the Boardwalk. I can't remember. I was trying to remember this the other day, the first time I ever met him. I'm sure it must have been in the Boardwalk or something. But I met him. He'd either just started working for the Spirals or pre-In Spirals. And I remember he was just like this really cool kid. You know, when you think about it now, he was super young.
Yeah.
And I remember speaking to him and he knew lots about the Beatles. And this is another thing, it's hard to explain now, because obviously with Spotify, with the internet, every 14-year-old music head in Britain knows everything about the Beatles. But then the Beatles weren't that cool, you know. It was really odd to meet somebody who was 18, 19, whoever he was at the time, and was a massive Beatles fan and knew lots about them, you know. So you could have a Beatles conversation.
Yeah.
So that was, I thought, well, this kid knows a lot about music. You know, he's on it. And he'd be a lot of gigs and he'd be watching very carefully and have a really good conversation about music with him. So he used to bump into him all the time. And then I was doing this kind of little musical side project called Sans Around. And I was doing it in a place called New Mount Street. And we had a little bit of publishing money. So we got a room in there where we set up a studio. We used to go in there all night to just make songs up. And it was like it was an old mill with about 40 little offices in it, like music business offices, because the people who owned the mill made them half price and that.
Got you.
And the Spirals were in there as well, and they had all their T-shirts in that place. And by about 2 in the morning, you'd be the only people in there, apart from Noel Gallagher, who you bump into quite a lot, sort of hovering around the Spirals office. And the running joke that we used to have for me and Alison Bell, who's part of the Manchester 50, used to go to all the gigs. Who's actually lived in the house where the Stone Roses did one of their first demos in the cellar.
Oh, wow.
And the little thing we always say is, what does Noel exactly do in the Spiral Carpet? So that was our long-running joke, because he was too cool to do any work. I mean, you never saw him carrying any amps around.
I think it was Tony McCarroll said, the only thing he had to do was sand down the drumsticks, and he used to hate sanding down the drumsticks. That was like his one job.
I think at that time in Manchester, every band had a cool mate. It was like the Mondays had Bez. It was you could have a band member who wasn't in the band, but who was in the band, if you know what I mean.
He didn't
record anything. You know, like Cresser in the Roadies had the best trousers. You know, Cresser had the bottle green flares that he gave to Ian Brown. That was, which when you think about it, it's a massive cultural contribution, which completely changed.
True, yeah.
Of course, the Roses, and I think of pop culture, it's not always about who could play guitar solos. You know, if the person's got the coolest haircut in a British band is as important as a great drummer. And the Roses kind of learned that from Cresser and from the Mondays as well. I mean, the Mondays were the core, weren't they? I mean, the Mondays, of all that culture, they were doing it without even knowing they were doing it. You know, and they were so cool that everybody kind of took stuff off them. And the Roses will tell you that, you know, they looked up to the Mondays. I mean, but the Roses, I mean, musically was something else, you know, doing... Just thinking about this the other day, just so much incredible depth to their music.
Yeah.
I mean, they fit into the scene we talk about now, but they go beyond that. You know, they're so utterly classic. What Noel managed to do is turn Stone Roses into a very mainstream, powerful pop music, which is a skill. That's not a lesser thing. That's amazing. Yeah. He took all the fancy bits out and just kept the tunes, didn't he?
It worked.
And it worked fantastically. Yeah, I mean, it's great when you have music with lots of depth, but it's also great when you have music that works as what it is. And Oasis does have a depth, but it's just... It's more sledgehammered. I mean, the Roses are more nuanced and more artsy. Yeah. There's a lot of John Squire in the Roses, you know, and he was pretty quiet, very introverted, but very artsy, and that puts lots of little levels in it. So you'd always see him around New Mount Street, see him a lot of gigs. And I remember bumping into him in the street as well. In fact, Noel's then girlfriend used to work on the desk at New Mount Street. and she was a friend of mine as well. So we see, because we'd always see her going into New Mount Street. So they were just part of all this little gang of people you saw around town. It's not, Manchester then is not like Manchester now. Manchester then was literally was, it was a Manchester 50 plus another 100 people doing stuff. It wasn't like now where it's, you know, a major music, media, cultural place where there's thousands of people involved in music stuff. I mean, then you would know them all. I mean, if I dug out my old address book from 1990, I'd probably got all the phone numbers still in it. I've got Kurt Cobain's mother's phone number in there.
Really?
I tell you what I found the other day. I found Noel's London home phone number in a bit of paper he gave me. Because I found, I just, you know, like in lockdown, when you're clearing out all the crap in your room.
Got you.
And I found this piece of paper. It was Noel and a London number on it. I thought, I don't know any Noels. I thought, oh, wait a minute, that must be Noel Gallagher.
Noel Gallagher. You can sell that, mate.
Well, that's the thing. I really can't sell any of this stuff. I find it really hard to sell. He gave me the first demo, or the one there's only six copies of, or whatever.
Right.
And I remember it was on Whitworth Street. He was coming out of India House where he lived, because he was living with that girl at the time in India House.
Yeah.
And so he gave me that, and I've still got that demo now, actually. And I thought that demo was great. But at that time, it was Post Sounds and it was Melody Maker, and they were so London orientated. I was trying to write about them, but they just wouldn't let me do a new band piece. I managed to do the second thing ever on Oasis, where you had to do your tips of the year.
Right.
For God almighty, what year would that be now? 92. I can't remember. It was them and the Caliphs, the Asian rap band from Rochdale, who were great actually, but just imploded. And Oasis. Then I saw some of the early gigs, and also because they rehearsed, that's the other thing, they rehearsed in the Boardwalk.
Right.
And I was rehearsing the Boardwalk at the time of Gold Blade, and we were just jumping into somebody else's room at the end, and they were next door, and whatever day you went in, they'd be in there rehearsing.
Got you.
And they literally would rehearse 6 hours a day. And it always seemed like they're rehearsing the riff from Eye on the Walrus over and over again. You know, and no band I ever knew would work that hard. You know what I mean? They weren't chancers, Oasis. I mean, they really worked. And Noel's got an incredible work ethic. I mean, driven, probably for two reasons, probably to escape Burnage, and probably to, in a way, because of the father situation, isn't it? You know, because it was an unhappy childhood, and it was only one way to beat those demons, and that was to actually prove himself absolutely massively, you know. Which his dad instead of kicking Noel, must be kicking himself now, mustn't he?
No, absolutely.
Well, the other thing about the Boardwalk was, which I thought was quite interesting, talk about the Roses, is when we used to rehearse next door to the Roses with my other band, the Membranes, in 83, 84, I had to go and get, and they would go in their room and out again, and we said, God, they look really hard, them. And then I had to go and get a string off one day and wait in the room, and it was a bit of trepidation. And then we got, of course, they're dead friendly, aren't they? They are some of the nicest people in the band. And they would say, well, we thought you were all psychopaths, and they thought we were dead hard. And also, because we were a top 10 indie band then, we were actually the big band, you know, they were like this local band. So it's kind of weird how that dynamic changes. And so I went to get a guitar string off, and then they used to give us a lift back to Didsbury, where we lived at the time, in Andy Cousins' van. That dates it, doesn't it? Because when they were a five piece.
Wow. But
I already knew Pete Garner, the bass player, from, because I went to the room and thought, oh, fuck, Pete, I didn't know you were in this band. And he goes, yeah, this is the band I was telling you about. Because he used to take my fanzine at Paper Chase. And Pete was the first person I got to know in Manchester when I came over from Blackpool and stuff. So we have so many little ties with them. But the thing about Oasis was, they're in the next door room, and I knocked on the door because I'd broken a guitar string, and Noel gave me a string. So I thought, that's pretty weird, that's the same thing's happened. And I went in the room and had a little chat, and that was the first time I think I probably met Liam, or that I may have met him before that.
Right.
But it's the first time I spoke to him properly was when they were rehearsing in that room. And of course, he's super friendly, and he's a dead nice bloke.
Right.
And I remember the Union Jack painted on the wall, you know, the famous Union Jack.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, because there's a... Yeah, I mean, that's interesting, isn't it? To have that Union Jack on the wall with them being Irish, you know, and I've always thought that was a bit weird.
it's pop culture though, isn't it? It's not Farage. It's the other end of the scale. This is about mod culture, pop culture, the Who.
Yeah.
So it's more towards that kind of thing, or the Beatles. I mean, I was thinking about Noel was, he was like the custodian of the British Pop Museum.
Right.
Because it's basically they boiled down all the great British rock and roll bands into one, didn't they? So
yeah,
it's quite simplistic to say they are just the Beatles cross the Sex Pistols, which is a big chunk of their sound and a genius idea. Because I remember in 1978, and there was a four-page ad in the music papers for a band called the Sex Beatles. And I don't think they even put a record out, but I remember reading it thinking, what a fucking ace idea. to the most classic band of all time, make it into one. You know, the only other person remembers that advert is Chris Packham. Because, you know, Chris really is punk.
Yeah, yeah, you've done stuff with Chris, haven't you?
Yeah, well, because he's born on exactly the same day as me, so we always have this little joke that we're twins, you know.
Wow.
but he's only the, because he's such a punk head and he's got such a mad little memory like I have, he can remember that ad, and he's the only other person that ever mentioned it. And the other time, or the context of that, I can remember it, was with Oasis being, who actually did it, just went ahead and did it, which made them the second greatest band that Croatian did or stroke should have signed, because the Roses were the band that McGee should have signed, really.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously getting the Oasis was a better one for the bank balance. And also that I still think of Oasis of being a Croatian band. I don't think of them being huge mainstream band. To me, they fit absolutely perfectly on Croatian records. They were everything that McGee always wanted. Because I know the music media has gone about them being a bit, you know, like Liam's a bit daft and all that, but they're actually really steeped and versed in British pop culture, and they understood British pop culture, knew it was the clothes, hair, music equation, and they knew all the vital points that join it all together. And that was Noel, because Noel studied it. I mean, you know, people now go to music college like BIM and do a three-year course in music. Noel did a 10-year course on the road in spiral carpets.
Yeah.
Plus being a kid before that, you know, going into Sifters, speaking to that guy who's still there actually behind the counter.
Yeah,
talk about music. Yeah, he's great. He's now been there a few times because I used to live near there, so I knew that street and stuff, because I used to live in Withington, the other side of the park, and that.
All right, great.
So in them days, yes. So I went in the room, and that Union Jack was because of that. And there's loads of football graffiti as well. And they used to have a running football graffiti standoff with the new fast automatic daffodils, who are United fans. So they'd be writing like things on each other's rehearsal room doors about City and United.
It's so childish, isn't it?
But it's all done for a laugh, because that's the other thing people forget, is how funny they are, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like Sean Ryder and Noel Gallagher could have made a living as a Northern nightclub comedian.
Yeah. You know,
your timing's absolutely impeccable, isn't it? You know that thing, if you say it a split second earlier, it's not funny, but if you get it that split second later, it's the funniest thing ever.
Yeah.
And that's what he's good at. And to be fair to the much maligned Morrissey, he can be really funny as well. I just wish, in fact, Morrissey's far better when he's being funny than when he's being serious, isn't he?
Yes, yeah. Let's not go into that right now. That's a podcast in itself.
This is the interesting thing about Oasis, isn't it? Because quite often I have to correct people, music journalists on Facebook, who go on about, you know, oikish northern bands and their sexist ladders and da 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 da, you know, those cliches, and like Oasis. They go, well, actually, Oasis aren't really like that at all, no. You know, remotely. I mean, you don't get a story about Noel Gallagher beating his wife up. You cannot find even a slightly racist quote from Noel. You know, when they go on about, oh, he's obviously a Tory now because he's into Brexit. No, he's not into Brexit. He's not a Tory. I mean, half the time he'd be taking the piss a bit.
Exactly.
But they're not a political band, but they're not they're not like a, but you know, like these bands that get to about 50 and turn into Tories.
Yeah.
It's not like that Oasis at all, you know. They just quietly just stayed exactly the same as they were when I first met them. They are totally unchanged, you know. I did interview Liam about 3 years ago, and I went in the room and he was so humble. I think he's quite humble anyway, but I think when you meet someone from years ago, the nose, it's hard not to be humble, because you just revert back into the roles that you first met. But what with Noel, I mean, I could text Noel now if he needs something, needs some, he usually sorts me out. But I don't like doing it, because I don't like getting favours off mates, really, you know.
I know what you mean. Yeah, it is difficult. It's like I've interviewed McGee quite a few times now, and he's brilliant, and he's sort of, he's become a bit of a mate, but like, And there's quite a few times when I think, oh, I could probably just ask McGee and he'd probably be able to sort that for me. But you just think, I don't want to bother the guy. You know what I mean? But it is it is amazing.
McGee loves doing it, though. I mean, I'm really close mates with McGee. I'm actually doing his documentary at the moment. They're making a doc to go with the film.
So oh, great. Okay.
The executive producer and that. So I've done some really long interviews with him. Well, stuff I kind of already knew because I know McGee from before creation. We go back super long way. And I mean, he's another one who's really unchanged by the money. I always forget that how loaded he is, actually.
Well, you don't realize, that's the thing. You don't even realize, but you know, cause he's just there in his like tracksuits and stuff. And like, you know, he's not that bothered. He's like, whereas there's other people that I've, you know, tried to get interviews with and you're going through record companies and you're hanging around and it's like, and they want to know all the listener stats and all this sort of stuff. Whereas McGee, it's like messaging him on Instagram. He's just happy to do it. You know, it's brilliant. He's just such a great guy. But
does that radio show, the need for
Boogaloo. Yeah.
Fantastic. But you know, they can't have, it's a web station. They're not going to have lots of listeners, but he doesn't care.
No.
He just likes doing it. I mean, I know he can afford to do it, but most people that amount of money just sit around their mansions and just around the world. You know, but he's actually signing up young bands because he likes the buzz of the young bands. He likes finding new music.
Who puts cuts in the can? I know two backhanders, course they can. That's just part and parcel of the humdrum in the hustle, man. Settling your debt, betting on roulette. That's what we get when narcissistic slippers stick us into more installment brands. Who puts stuff to the mat? Banner two backhanders, course they can. Cause that's just part and parcel of the humdrum. Everything is fine, everything is an and dynamite. The dreams are sailing from a transit van. The future is not what it was. The future is not as good as it was. The future is not what it was. The future is not as good as it was.
Which is amazing. I mean, he can make his living off his back catalogue. I mean, he does. I mean, he doesn't need to put another record out. He doesn't need to go and DJ in a bar to 60 people. No. He doesn't really need to go and do in conversations up and down the country to 100 people. No. I mean, the money he's getting paid for that is a joke to what he's earning every hour off trusting his instincts and signing great bands on Creation Records. I mean, he deserves every penny he earned. Because when you're someone like McGee, you're creating dreams that lift the people out of the doldrums. I mean, that's the other thing people forget about Oasis is that they made millions of people feel completely brilliant, you know, and that's worth getting paid for, isn't it?
No, definitely, mate. That's brilliantly put, actually. But what about with the rise of them then? Were you then taken aback, John, once they did start to get, you know, obviously you'd done that first sort of article on, well, what was it, second mention ever in the music press and stuff? But did you sort of think, well, this is going to be like Roses level, or could you foresee actually, no, this is like U2 level here?
It could only ever be Roses level at the time because Roses seemed to be, that felt like the biggest you're ever going to get with that kind of music. You know, like if you've been to Spike Island, that would be the high watermark and things. I mean, you've got to remember for a long time, Oasis, about 2, maybe 3 years, no one went to see them. I remember going to the early gigs, but I remember going, seeing them when they played that in the City gig. I remember it really clearly, you know, and you felt for it because normally in the city at the time, there'd be at least 20 mates to come and cheer a band on, but there's no one watching them. I remember I was watching from the side, not I wasn't on the stage, but stood sideways on from the PA, and I could see how empty it all was and things, you know, and it seemed like they were going nowhere, but I couldn't really understand it because they were obviously really good, you know. But then culturally at that point of time, the vibe was at Manchester, that was it, but the people in Manchester, London would say Manchester's had its turn. Like you have to have a turn. Bands, you know, like, oh, you've had some success. Well, that's too much. Like it's another city now. It doesn't really work like that music, does it? If you're good, you're good. Mm. I mean, but I think one of the things that people always forget that gave them a bit of space is when Nirvana broke through, it made music a little bit heavier again. And in a sense, Oasis are heavy, but they do sound heavy. It's interesting that a lot of the kind of rockers in America, you know, what's he called? Bloody Foo Fighters.
Dave Grohl.
Dave Grohl loves them, doesn't he? And the guys at Metallica love them because Oasis are actually a really good rock band. You know, when you see them live, it is a wall of sound. It's pretty impressive, heavy wall of sound. It's not, they're not, I mean, they write great songs, but they're not they're not a light pop band at all, you know. It's but maybe sonically Nirvana created that space where that became a mainstream music, because Nirvana's success was astonishing, you know, when they went from basically when I'd seen him play to 10 people, or within a year they were sold 13 million records. It was, yeah. You talk about Oasis overnight success when he finally got there, and Nirvana's was like insane.
Light my candles in our days, 'cause I found God. Yeah, 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 yeah. I'm so lonely.
There was a template for how you could go from nowhere to masters making music that wasn't totally compromising, but it was difficult to see at that time. But then when they started getting out of Manchester, because that was always their thing, they always said they were more of a Liverpool band. Yeah. And I knew the real people because I'd interviewed the real people, and they'd already talked to me about doing, maybe I think I've got the demo of real people, but real people taught them quite a lot, you know. Harmonies, they taught them. The real people were brilliant at harmonies. They knew about melody, and it was two brothers fighting. So there you go. They taught them that. and also the real people can't. I think they knew the Sex Beatles thing as well. They could see that, and they did all the demos, didn't they, in their little studio boot? Or I've been that studio before. And the other thing I remember really early on, and I remember Noel when they did the gig in Glasgow. I bumped into Noel a couple of days later. And he was sounding me out about McGee. And I was, when he said McGee's interested, I go, fuck. That is so perfect. I don't believe it.
Oh, great.
I can't think of a better label to be on because McGee, he totally understands you, but also McGee's ambitious. And he's not going to see you as being like a little cult band. McGee wants, every band McGee signs, he genuinely believes they're going to be the number one band in the world.
Yeah.
So whether it was Meat Whiplash in the early days who sold 1,000 records or Oasis sold millions, his belief was genuine. You know, his instinct told him these bands are brilliant. And it can be a brilliant band, but if the moment's not right, it doesn't work. But he got it right with Oasis. I remember saying to Noel, no, he's perfect. And also I could see the relationship between them because Noel was a great pupil learning. And really immersed in British pop culture. But as you know, speak to McGee. McGee is a brilliant pop culture person. He knows the equation. Yeah. He knows the music, shoes, hair, great chorus equation. Mm. And also, you don't really have to compromise that much to make it. So and any other label would have fucked Oasis up. They would have gone in there trying to make us something they weren't and pissed them off.
Yeah.
But McGee he kind of like let them be what they were, but just moved it slightly. Just moved the whole thing slightly to one side, and it went through, didn't it? And then it just went really fast. Once they're on Croatian, they look cool because they had a veneer of Croatian's cool labels. They had a veneer of coolness about them.
Right.
It was based in London, so it wasn't a parochial Manchester thing. It was already locked into London, and then they just went out and started playing. And I remember, I think was it Avon and Park at Preston next time I saw them, and it just suddenly gone insane. It was like I remember loads of people just turning up. It was like, whoa, this is really happening. I bumped into Noel before that gig as well, actually. I remember having a big chat with them backstage before the gig, and you could sense something was going on there.
Yeah, we want to fucking play for you lot, right? So don't start. Any more of that and we'll just fuck off. We're not fucking dickheads and we're not Blur. Alright, well, there's your first song fucking finished anyway.
No,
so you're going to behave, huh? You're going to behave?
Yeah.
Then I remember I was in London when they played the Marquee. I didn't actually go to it because I had to do something else. But I remember going past the Marquee and there was a massive queue outside. I was thinking, fuck, this is really happening. You've got London now. You know, this is like the Roses without the 5-year wait that the Roses had to put up with.
Yeah. Well, I've heard that basically that they could have on that tour, that actually they could have cancelled those gigs and like, you know, instead of playing the clubs, they could have then booked, you know, a theatre, you know, or bigger, you know, like 1,000 sort of rather than 300. But they deliberately kept them low. And that was like Marcus Russell being like, no, it's much better to turn away 700 people and have those 700 people desperate to see him next time they come back and be talking about the fact that it was sold out. And they took, you know, and that created that much like a buzz, like you're saying, like people are queuing in the door. What is going on? You know, so that's an interesting, I think that's Marcus Russell. Like, I don't think maybe gets enough credit actually for little things like that he probably came up with.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure his exact role about, but I know obviously it's important. I think he brought a good business head to it, and I think when you look at it, Johnny Marr, I mean, the advice that Johnny Marr did when he went to that gig when he played, which actually was that gig when he played the Whiteout in Manchester, didn't they? At Manchester University, because I'd written about Whiteout actually as well, so I knew all these bands.
Yeah,
they're called Whiteout.
Yeah, Whiteout. Yeah, because it started out the Whiteout with a headliner and Oasis were supporting, but then they had to switch it around halfway through
because it went mental.
Yeah,
but Whiteout were a really good band. See, that's an example of it doesn't always fall your way, even if you're good, you know. So it's I think what Whiteout didn't have was he didn't have Liam, and I think Liam was such a fantastic rock and roll star. Whiteout looked good as a band, as a unit, and they had that little denim look, didn't they? And they're that Scottish thing, which is always cool. Anybody from anywhere near Glasgow has got that innate love of rock and roll and understanding of it. And they had a really cool manager as well, Mick D, who used to run the club up in Greenock, who, if you phoned them up, it was 4 hours later, he just talked non-stop for 4 hours. He's an amazing character. I remember when I went up to interview them, they did a gig on New Year's Day in Greenock, and it took forever to get there in them days. And we stayed at McGee's flat because it's a sound. You never got hotels or sounds. and he had the dampest flat in the world. And I've got the worst cold ever. And then about 2 years later, he had some really weird Victorian disease, like consumption or something. And he was really ill for years. I was thinking, I can see why that flat. It's just mouldy and damp and cold. It's just full of records and a bed and a mouldy carpet. And we didn't. And no one slept because he just talked all night, you know, because he had this amazing vision, you know, up on it. See, that's the thing, you need your Marcus Russells, you need McGee. These people are brilliant. I mean, McGee's actually a really good business, but D was just a total music head, and probably the business side of it, and the idea of doing the right gigs and you know, pulling out here and do this one there. The strategy is what you need. And I always think the best bands are more than just the band, aren't they? When you look at the people all the way around Oasis,
yeah,
it's amazing. And also, I think ultimately, the manager of Oasis has always been Noel Gallagher.
Yeah,
who knew what he was doing right from day one. He understood the whole picture, didn't he? Because he'd been around the world with Spiral Carpets. He'd been in South America. He'd seen the Spirals play to 10,000 people. He knew the game roles because he was taught. A lot of stuff came from Clint. Clint Boone is very smart. Well, you know, he's very savvy. And Clint was always good at business. The Spirals were one of the first bands I met in Manchester who understood how to run it as a business. You know, at the time, coming out of punk, business was a dirty word.
Yeah.
Which is stupid, really, because how the hell are you going to survive otherwise, you know, if you've got no money? I mean, the rest of us would go, oh, no, we don't do it as a business. But I mean, you could do art and business together and it keeps you on the road longer. And Noel learned all that. So they had a really good set of people around them. I remember I met Marcus at the Manchester. We also met in Amsterdam because I went to see Oasis at their first gig in Amsterdam when they played some really weird little gig just before they broke out there, but you could totally see it going big, you know. That was a cool night. Yeah, it wasn't a Paradiso kind of venue. It was some other weird place.
Was that not the Amsterdam one where they got chucked off the ferry? Because I don't think they ended up getting to that gig. So you did actually get to see them in Amsterdam?
I seen them play in Amsterdam, but which gig it was, maybe I'll just look it up now while we're talking. But it was a gig. And I remember being at the gig, and I remember talking to Marcus. You know, one of those gigs when it's dead good and you just talk to each other, go, fuck, this is brilliant, fuck, this is brilliant, just all the way through the gig and that. And there was about a couple of hundred people there. It was before they really broke massive and stuff. So they definitely made the gig. They're up in the league.
So that was one of the trips to Amsterdam they did actually make. Oh, fair enough.
Yeah.
What about then when once the rise has happened and then the first album comes out and it sort of sells millions, did you stay in touch with them throughout that period and then like going into then Morning Glory as well?
Oh, yeah. I mean, actually, I've just found it. It's Amsterdam Arena, September 1994.
Got you. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's kind of, they're already on the way in the UK, but they were just not that known. They just did a couple of Euro days, didn't they? Mm. Yeah. They were still in town then, so you still bump into them. I bumped into Noel Annerly at the Lemonheads gig in Manchester. I think that was when they were just on the way up, when they went to check out Lemonheads play. I mean, this is the thing that people have this idea that they didn't really like any of the music apart from two Beatles cassettes or something. That's the sort of running joke. But they Noel's definitely at all the gigs. He knew his stuff, and he was taking Liam around with him, you know. So they'd be checking out a lot of things. And Bonehead's a big music head. I mean, Bonehead, he liked it. I mean, in the early days, he definitely cultivated the image of being, you know, the super yob, like a slave. But you know, you just have to look at the first album cover to know what Bonehead's like. He's got varnished wooden floorboards. I mean, this is
well, plastering plays pretty well. Plastering plays better than pub rock, punk rock, anyway, John.
Yeah, well, it certainly does. Yeah, I mean, I used to live round the corner from that house on Burton Road, and our house was nothing like his house. So our house is like a madhouse, about 20 people living in it. The wooden floorboards and ours actually fell through from one floor into the other. I didn't know you could do wooden like a palace. I mean, it looked really nice, his house. Didn't look so nice. I mean, and that time, Didsbury was more a bed city, whereas now all those houses look like that inside because it's more money and stuff. Right. In fact, I knew Bonehead's brother before Bonehead. His brother's called Arthur, and he used to do desks, look after the desk at Sweet 16. He used to do the AMEC desks, so he's an engineer. So I mean, that's the thing about Manchester. Everybody knows everybody else, you know. Everyone knows everybody else's brother as well. Mm.
Well, that's often the case. Yes, it's like I know Mary McGuigan a bit, and I think she's friends with Bonehead's sister and things like that. And it is, but that's the thing. If you were going to those gigs all the time, and you obviously any band, you drag your siblings along. That's got to be the case. But that is fantastic.
Yeah, when you talk about the 50, it's actually more than, it's probably 200 because of the other people you see around at gigs as well. And that would be somebody's brother or sister or cousin. I mean, I'm not from Manchester, but everybody I've ever met in Manchester seems to have about 20 cousins, especially all the Irish families. They have these extended. And the other thing that was really interesting at the time, which didn't happen to Oasis, but happened to every other band, they would have like, you know, you go see Northside's first gig, there'd be 400 people there. You know, they actually had a whole following, like a football following.
Yeah.
But Oasis didn't have that. And they were one of the first bands in that period that didn't seem to have a big gang of followers, which is quite odd when you think about it, isn't it? I mean, maybe not Noel, because he's been on the road for ages and lost track of people. But you think Liam and everyone else could have all their mates up from Burnage as their little crew to follow them around.
Maybe they just didn't want to... You know, Noel... Yeah, but like, I've heard that like Noel was quite a Well, what you hear is, like, I interviewed Paul Ashby, the big one, and he was saying, like, he called him Nobody Knows Me Noel, and he was like a very shy guy that wouldn't really have that many friends. And then Liam, maybe the fact that he was, you know, not ashamed, but, you know, would he have wanted his football mates to come and see him sing? I think for an arrogant kind of, you know, obviously outgoing person, I always get that impression that he is quite, you know, nervous even about going on stage and showing that side of him.
Yeah, I think they're both quite introverted characters, really, but they learnt, well, like a lot of people in rock and roll, and there's a front which you put out there if you're smart, and there's the other person that you could just get on with being yourself, you know. And it's, Liam's actually really sweet, you know. You see all those stories, don't you, about a 16-year-old kid bumps into Liam in Camden somewhere, and he says, "Oh, you know, you're playing in 6 months, I can't afford to go." And he says, "I'll put you on the guest list."
Yeah.
And they turn up and he's got them on the guest list. Yeah. And you go, "Fuck, how did he remember?" You know, so they've always looked after the fans, haven't they? You know, and I think that's
definitely
overlooked quite a lot as well, isn't it? Well, I think a lot of the I mean, if you want to do some COD psychology on it, I mean, obviously the situation with the father didn't really help. You know, I mean, not in a way they're completely damaged. They're careful, aren't they? You know, it's, you know, if it was an unpleasant situation at home, one, and I think that's affected him in some kind of way. You know, it's made him probably slightly more withdrawn than they would have been.
Yeah, no, definitely, I think so. No, and what about into the later years, John? Did you, in terms of the music itself, I suppose, like, were you like a big fan of the music particularly? I know you've got like a very wide ranging taste of music, but then from the definitely maybe it was quite a shift then to Morning Glory, which has its rockier moments, but then is a lot more acoustic-y. And then obviously we go on to the madness of Be Here Now and then beyond. So what was your kind of view of music as it kind of shifted over the years?
So yeah. Be Here Now, it was too bombastic with a single. So he set it off on the wrong path. And also because Noel slags it off all the time. I mean, he said it's his cocaine record.
Yeah.
To the guitar overdose. But now actually when you go back to listen to it, some of the tracks are great. They're like psychedelic mantras, aren't they? You know, there's so much going on in them. They actually do make me trip out a bit. I wonder with Oasis, did they get so popular that people judge them on terms of their popularity, not the music? A bit like what the Beatles used to get, the people used to talk about them as a cultural phenomenon, you know, or that they're just, you know, they're in your face all the time. I'm sick of it. Like, it's not really their fault that they're that popular. I know, and everybody has an opinion on you as well. And so, like, so let's say, I don't know off the top of my head, Nick Cave makes great records now. And he does really well, but outside his fans, most people don't listen to him. So most people don't really have an opinion on him. Whereas Oasis is so big at the time that everybody had an opinion on it. So all the people didn't like him could slag him off. And it just seemed... So like by the time you get deeper into the career, there's an awful lot of people slagging them off. Who probably, if they'd been half the size, would never have heard them.
Yeah, no, I agree. And it's also like, I think because they had this image of the two brothers fighting and the, like you said, the music press really playing up this sort of arrogant, you know, these yobbish northerners versus the like art school blurb, you know, nice southern boys, which was, you know, completely not right. But I think that thing, like even now when I talk to people, like you go, oh, what, Oasis? Oh, what? Oh, yeah, those two brothers. Oh, yeah, I never liked them. You know, and you just instantly, you've got that thing, which was so, you know, which was, so in a way, it's frustrating because a lot of people then don't go to the music beyond that and go, no, the music is great. You know, it isn't just about, oh, yeah, those two brothers, I never liked them. But then also it's that mixed, it's a mixed blessing as well, because it was that then made them have the breakthrough. Whereas, yeah, maybe the likes of White Out or these other bands didn't have that sort of crux that did get them into...
Yeah, I mean, nobody ever slagged White Out off because nobody ever heard them, which is a conundrum, isn't it? It wasn't their fault. I mean, if you listen to them now, they still sound good. I mean, I think, do you think they really care that much? I don't think they really care that people misunderstand them or whatever. You know, they're totally, you know, when you sold that many records, it really does not matter anymore. I mean, one thing I've always really liked about them, they never craved critical acclaim. And another thing I was thinking about today, you know, with the end of Q magazine and that, and people going, what happened? I mean, you know, why do people not read magazines, papers anymore? You know, I had to close my magazine down, etc. But I think, in a way, one, obviously people are online now, which everyone knows, but maybe the death knell of music journalism holding any weight was perhaps Oasis, who just took it off anyway. You know, it wasn't, you know, nowadays people say it was all hype, but there was no hype. The music papers didn't really like them very much. In fact, when I interviewed Noel a few years ago, he had this great quote. He said, they set the stage for Blur to be the main band in Britpop, And then we turned up and they never forgave us.
Yes, I remember that quote. What was happening,
because Blur was in the London thing, you know, it was Andy Ross, who actually was at Sounds when I was at Sounds. And we used to have massive arguments, editorials about the Stone Roses, because he used to say that how terrible they were. And then he managed to mould Blur into like a little version of Stone Roses, the first single. I mean, I think Blur are a good band. I think Damon Albarn's amazing talent, and I think Graham's a great guitar player. I think the Cheesemaker's a great bass player. You know, yeah. I did go see him live a few years ago at the arena. I thought, fucking hell, he's a kick-ass bass player.
Yeah, no,
he's another one you just wish wouldn't do interviews, isn't he?
No, exactly. and hang around with David Cameron, and that, oh God.
Yeah, I know.
God, I hate awesome, it. God. I can't stand it. And you just see it in Graham's face, can't you? Just like, oh God, I've got to put up with it.
He's more for my kind of punk rock world, Graham. So,
yeah.
But they were a good band. But the rivalry was good for both of them, wasn't it? But as McGee always says, you know, when in the chart battle, we lost the battle, but we won the war, didn't we?
Yeah, absolutely. So, what do you think, John? As looking back now, it's been sort of 25 years coming up for Morning Glory this year, and then we had 25 years, definitely maybe this year. And now we're just constantly in these 25 year sort of. Anniversary sort of things. When you look back on Oasis, having had that extra 10 years of, as well, of not being as big, sort of from the late 90s to the late 2000s, it's a funny old legacy, really. You know, it is a strange one when you think about that band. I mean, how do you look back at them now, sort of, you know, 10 years on from them having split, 25 years on from their greatest, you know, albums, as the legacy of that band and what they've meant to music since?
It's interesting to talk about a time thing, because initially it seems such a rush, and they seem like it's such a rush to get everywhere. You think, wow, they've done two albums in very, very quickly. Singles coming out every 10 weeks. There's, you know, there was a point in time when you go, fucking hell, within 3 years, they've done all this work. They've just non-stop. And now it's all, now this is, because you know, you get this now, you get older. Everything is 25 years ago, and it did seem super instant when it was going, like all the best pop culture should be of the moment, isn't it? It's there, bang, on, next thing. Now, what's their legacy now? Well, I think actually their legacy holds up a mirror to the way the music industry is, in a sense, because that thing I was saying to you before about the music media not, you know, like, and the mainstream music, it's not really wanting them there, in a sense. So if you read most stuff that people write about that period of time, they're grudgingly included in the history of it, aren't they? You know, it's like, we can't ignore them because they're too big, so we better put them in. But anyway, let's get back to Blur. So. And that's not fair on Blur, because in the end, I mean, you know that you just know that Damon Albarn's looking at Oasis going, fuck, that Noel's so talented. You know, it's been like T-Rex and Bowie in the 70s, in the sense that Bowie was a brilliant conceptualist, and everything he did, Bowie is Damon Albarn. He could copy anything and make it seem like it is, but it's all thought out. Then he writes a song.
Yeah.
But Mark Bolan, he just pick up a guitar and write a brilliant song with three chords and nonsense lyrics. And it would mean everything to everybody. And that's what Noel does. And I think that idea that Oasis never advanced or never went forwards or never changed what music's like, it isn't that important. Mm. That's not their job. Why would you want Oasis to do that when you've got the Aphex Twin doing it? Aphex Twin's amazing. Yeah. He pushes the boundaries, invents new rhythms, new textures. He's a fucking genius at it.
Mm.
But Aphex Twin cannot write a 2 minute, 30 long song that you could play to 50,000 people and change their mood in a second.
Yeah.
And that's a genius thing to be able to do as well. And it's not just writing that song, but delivering it as well. You know, it's that thing that, but like Elvis did, you know, you give Elvis a song and the songwriters, they put in the most stupid lyrics possible because they thought Elvis was just some dumb hick. Then Elvis sing it and they go, fucking hands up. He's just made that sound like it means everything. And that's what Liam could do. You could just take any bit of doggerel that Noel stuck on the back of an envelope and make it sound like it meant everything.
Yeah.
And that's a skill as well. you don't have to be a songwriter. That's what Liam, the smartest thing Liam did was get songwriters in. It doesn't matter. You know, people go on, he doesn't write his own songs, da da da. I don't buy into Liam Gallagher as a songwriter, although he can write good songs himself. Mm. But Liam's job is to deliver songs, and that's a fucking challenge, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, Frank Sinatra never wrote any songs, and he was one of the greatest singers of all time. And it's, you know, the worst thing the Beatles did was make everybody believe they had to be a songwriter. You know, it's, I mean, not everybody's got three of the best songwriters of a decade in their band.
You know what, John? You've basically said exactly what I've said on a number of times when this debate has always come up. Ben, it's normally like the Noel fans in the Oasis kind of world saying, oh, Liam doesn't write his own songs. And then I make that point about Sinatra and Elvis and Supremes, you know, none of the you know, not many of the Motown people ever wrote their own songs. It was, you know, I know, like, obviously Smokey Robinson wrote a lot of them and stuff like that. But
just great talent. They're all different talents, aren't they? I mean,
yeah.
Well, it's like Bez and the Mondays. I mean, Bez didn't even sing, but without Bez, the Mondays wouldn't work.
Yeah, love it.
Bez is the front man. He dances around for a minute, gets knackered, sits on the drum riser. And he's fucking ace, isn't it? It's just completely weird, but it's really mesmerising.
Yeah.
And it's pop, it's not opera, it's not classical music. You don't need an obvious talent to be talented. You know, you could be charismatic. You know, I remember having this discussion with Rennie one night about the Stone Roses, and he couldn't understand the massive adulation that Ian Brown got by our Saints book. But Rennie, you must understand that when Ian Brown walks on the stage, everybody's watching him. He's just got that thing. He's not cultured that. He's never learned how to do it. He just has it. You know, it's not a skill you're given or you can learn in a college. You either have it or you don't. And Liam's got it. You know, he has that thing when he's on stage. Even if he's standing there doing absolutely fuck all, what does he call that? His art thing. It's really funny, isn't it? Oh God, is it? Noel told me once. Liam goes, "It's fucking art." No, it's you know, I've weighed up this type of art. I just stand there and they all look at me. I can't remember what it was. It now I can't remember. It's the whole thing, and it's actually quite clever that, you know, like most rock and roll performers embrace the crowd and pull them in. But Liam would stand there and the audience would have to entertain him, which he got off Johnny Rotten actually, but he did his own version of it. And Stillism, he calls it.
Stillism.
Yeah. Like he's just standing there looking really bored and then everybody's really drawn into it.
Yeah.
Going, wow, what's he going to do? What's he going to do? He's not doing anything. He's watching us all. But not, you know, most people can't do that. You know, you have to have a specific charisma to pull that off. The genuine meaning of the word X Factor probably got ruined by a series where they found absolutely nobody who actually had any X Factor at all, which is ironic.
That is a very good point.
X Factor's that cool kid at school that, you know, for whatever reason, they might not even be the coolest looking kid, but there's just something about them that everybody's watching them. What watch have they got on? What shoes they got on? You know, they just have that thing, don't they? And, you know, and then multiply that by a million and you got those, you know, those Ian Browns or you got those Liams. And when you see other bands who are pretty big and they don't have that, it's kind of odd. I mean, you think they've got the songs, they can hold the crowd, and then you think, which one's the singer?
Yeah, something's missing. It was interesting. McGee said this to me. I'm sure he said it on a number of interviews before, but he had that thing where, you know, when he first saw them hanging around in King Tut's and he sort of saw Liam and thought, you know, oh God, I hope he's the singer. Like you just saw his handsome guy. I hope he's not the drug dealer. I hope he's a singer. And then, so as much as McGee, like we were saying, as much as McGee talks about like, oh, it's about the music, he knew then, even just seeing this bunch of kids in the corner, like he knew, right, having the good looking charismatic singer is very important. And, you know, and that's as much as we love music and it's all about the music, man. Come on, you've got to have that X factor, haven't you?
For me, it's the whole thing, I think. I mean, I love Cats and Beefheart. Well, Cats and Beefheart's charismatic in a sense. It's like an anti-charisma, which is equally intriguing. Mm. Johnny Rotten's the same. I mean, Johnny Rotten's not utterly unconventional, but mesmerising in the early days, you know, when he was younger.
No fun. No fun. This is no fun. No fun. It is no fun at all. No fun.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated? Good night.
That thing about, and also he has that thing where he's supremely confident but also incredibly nervous. Mm. So it's the awkwardness was quite fascinating. And Liam, in a sense, there is that, like we talked about that before. He might be 90% front, but you can still sense that 10% thing there, you know, which always makes I find that interesting, that you know, that slight uncertainty makes for a great front person, you know. Mm. I mean the one who was really confident was Noel, because Noel knew he was good, you know.
Yeah, it's different, isn't it?
Well, all Noel's doing is waiting for the audience to turn up.
John, well, thank you, mate. I'll tell you what, thank you so much for your time this evening. I'll let you go because I know you've had a busy old day of like a lot of talking.
Of course. If you want to do a part two, there's plenty more stuff.
I bet, mate. You know, and thank you so much, mate. It's been absolutely brilliant. If the kids want to find you online, what's the best route for that?
Just tweet me, John Rob 77. Yeah.
And you've got Loud and War as well, the website.
Yeah.
Wonderful. All right, John, thank you so much for your time, mate. Much appreciated.
Well, thanks. Yeah, good luck with everything. Yeah.
Cheers, mate. All the best. Alright, thank you very much to John Rob. Greatly appreciated. Make sure you're checking out, follow John on Twitter at JohnRob77, and Louder Than War website is where you want to go and get all your music news. And what a great guy. I don't think I've ever done like an hour long interview where I've said less than with John Rob. And just the whole reason why I got in touch with him was like Rockfield Studios, because that documentary has just been on TV and John was there at Rockfield Studios when they were recording Morning Glory. And he's got this brilliant story about, when it all kicked off. And I'm like about 10 minutes after the interview, I thought, oh, yeah, that's the whole point I was going to talk to him about. But anyway, yeah, he did say he'll come on and do a part two. So we'll grab him again at some point. I'm sure we could do about 10 parts with John. He's absolutely brilliant. Right, a couple of bits before we finish today. Just to let you know that there's a brilliant new fanzine out called Speakeasy. It's about Britpop and indie and all that sort of stuff. I've contributed an article to the second issue. But the first issue is out now. It only costs like £1 or £1.50 or something, and you get like an old-fashioned paper fanzine posted to your door. So yeah, definitely worth checking out. And I noticed a few more people, I don't know if it's maybe being on lockdown or something, but a few more people are getting a bit more creative and like selling stuff. So I know that like Columbia Pins is a pin badge maker that's done some really cool pins recently. They've got a Liam one coming up. There's also another one as well called, I think, Pin Icons. You know, really cool pins. Susie, who's at the Songbird, I know she's been doing like face masks, but she's been doing like indie band face masks, or like Primal Scream and Liam like face masks and stuff, which is really cool. If you're going to have a face mask, why not wear an indie-based one? And then you've got the likes of like Brits and Pieces. You know, he's a cool guy. He's got his own store selling loads of interesting stuff now. I got a set of like Oasis pencils off him. But he's opening it up. He's even been talking about doing like a compilation album of new bands and stuff. And obviously we've got the likes of Supernova Terraceware as well, who like helped design my logos. He does amazing sort of T-shirts and hoodies and all that sort of stuff. So it's interesting. And maybe this lockdown thing is sort of people are getting a bit more creative and coming up with different things. So it's cool. Just to point out, the 1001 Albums Pod is going from strength to strength. Do please go and follow that at 1001 Albums Pod. If you haven't heard of that before, that's where I talk to people about different classic albums. We've had Alan McGee on there talking Ziggy Stardust. I've had my mate Joel from the Movie Multiverse podcast do Green Day and Michael Jackson. We've had Danny Burton do The Who. And we've had Tejinder from Corner Shop do Corner Shop. And coming up soon, we've got Katie Georgiou. We're doing Amy Winehouse, who she went to school with. And I should have some really big names as well. So it's a mixture of people that you've heard of from the podcast, people from other bands, and people that actually made the albums themselves. So it's really good. Please do go and check it out. Right, before we go, we've had a message in from Paul Parker, who's a musician and a fan of the podcast. And this is fantastic. So I'm going to hand over to Paul.
Hey there, everyone. I'm Paul. I'm a songwriter and musician. You may not have heard of me, but I'm a huge Oasis fan as well. Well, I say huge, but I'm only 5'4". So, you know, not that huge. I make Noel Gallagher look rather lanky, I guess. But before I start, let's just address the elephant in the room, shall we? I have a Bristolian accent, me lover. That may have something to do with me being from the city of Bristol, me lover.
Get off my fucking land! Get off my land!
So yeah, there we go. I got a little brief little bit of history for you with Oasis in Bristol. We got they played in, I think for the first time possibly, in 1994. 30th of March, they played the old Fleece and Firkin. Yeah, that's how you say it in Bristol. The Fleece and Firkin, like, me lover. And then, according to setlist.com, their setlist included a song called, hang on, let me just check it. Sorry, there are no songs in this setlist yet. I've not heard of that song, but it's probably written by Noel, and it's probably a cracker. but anyway, Noel also played the Colston Hall with Paul Weller in 1998 and 7th of July. This is all off the top of my head. No, I'm reading it. Yeah, so Noel played an acoustic set at the Colston Hall before Weller came on, I believe, in 1998. And Noel and his High Flying Birds also played the Downs Festival, the Bristol Downs, on the 1st of September 2018. And I was there. And Mr. Paul Weller also, he always seems to come to Bristol with Paul Weller, doesn't he, old Noel? But anyway, perhaps he's scared to come to Bristol without Mr. Weller, but hey, who knows? So Paul Weller joined Noel on stage towards the end of the set to play a tune called Malice, which was very good.
We're going to get the Mud Father out. Is there some?
And also, the last final fact about Bristol and Oasis is Acquiesce was written in a seven-tunnel junction, which is half in Bristol and half in Wales, if you like. I know Louise from Stop Crying Your Heart Out News is going to say, no, no, it was written in Wales, but no, clearly, the tunnel belongs to Bristol. We'll say that. The tunnel's about 55% in Bristol, and yeah, so that's what we'll say. It's not really true, but hey. Anyway, the whole point of this little audio message is really, as I had a thought, a vision, let's say. If we rewrite history for the moment and say, back in 2009, Oasis didn't really split up. They didn't split up, they'd just taken a break. Okay, so they haven't recorded an album. They're having a break. We just haven't, you know, heard from them since then. They've gone on holiday and they're getting their suntans, etc. Until now. In 2020, they're coming back with a brand new album. An Oasis album. Okay? They've all been writing tracks between 2009 and 2020. And those tracks are... what you can include are High Flying Birds tracks, the BDI tracks, and Liam's solo tracks. Okay, so the question is, for their long awaited follow up album to Dig Out Your Soul, okay, what songs would they choose out of BDI, Noel High Flying Birds, and Liam's solo career, what songs would they pick to be a great album as their follow-up to Dig Out Your Soul? So the rules are, all songs from BDI are available. You've got Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds songs and Liam's solo career songs. You can swap the singers around as well if you want, just let us know. So, here's mine, for example. So I've got 5 Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds tracks, I've got 3 BDI songs and 4 solo Liam tracks. So the album opens up with Everybody's on the Run, with Liam singing. Yeah, no, crazy, huh? And then number 2, the track 2 is 4 Letter Word, the BDI track, with obviously Liam singing. Number 3 is 4 What It's Worth, the Liam solo first album song. And number 4, it's another BDI track, it's Standing on the Edge of the Noise. Number 5, If I Had a Gun, Noel Gallagher singing that one. Greedy Soul is at number 6, I just thought I'd put it in there because it sounds like it could be on an Oasis album. Number 7 would be Noel singing Dead in the Water. Number 8 is The Beat Goes On, another BDI song, what am I doing? Anyway, number 9 is Lock All the Doors with Liam singing. Okay. Number 10 is The Dying of the Light with Liam singing. Number 11 is The River, Liam's solo, off his second solo album. And the 12th track on this album will be Once, from Liam's Why Me, Why Not album. So that is my comeback Oasis album. Okay. So if anyone else wants to have a go, I'm sure it'd be cool. I'd love to hear what other people have in their mind for that. But so the vision is, remember, Oasis didn't split at all in 2009. They just took a break, like One Direction. You know, I can't even say that word. But yeah, so imagine they've got all these tracks from the BDI period, from the Liam solo career and Noel's, and you've got all them. Put them into one album. That will be the next Oasis album in this kind of parallel universe. What would you pick? Those songs I picked aren't particularly all my favourites. It's just kind of what I would think what the Oasis album would sound like. It's just a bit of fun at the end. No one's right, no one's wrong, but I'm clearly right. Okay, so yeah, you can catch me anyway on Spotify and iTunes and Deezer and Amazon Music and YouTube. You'll find me under PJP, that's PJP. And yeah, here's a bit of my music. I'm a songwriter, I don't tend to sing, so if I can help it, because I don't want to, you know, smash any windows in your house. Here you go. Just like a gun.
Thank you very much for that, Paul. Greatly appreciated. Very entertaining. Well put together. Yeah, that's an interesting one. BDI, Noel Gallagher, High Flying Birds, and Liam solo. I've not done that one before. I've done a best of album of just the first BDI and the first Noel Gallagher and mixed those together. And I've even sort of mixed together Who Built the Moon and As You Were, but I've never mixed together the whole of the careers, the solo careers. That's an interesting one. Yeah, feel free if anyone wants to do that. Yeah, fire it in following Paul's rules, and yeah, it'd be interesting. We'll definitely play it on the podcast. All right, that'll do it for this week.
So it just remains to me to say thank you very much for listening to the Oasis podcast, and thank you very much, most importantly, to our patrons. You put your money where your mouth is, and it's greatly, greatly appreciated. You can become a patron at patreon.com/oasispod, which is where we post extra episodes, and we post episodes a couple of days early, and articles and all kinds of other things going on over there. So do please head over there and sign up if you can spare me a couple of quid a month. Do please follow Twitter, Instagram and Facebook at Oasis Podcast. And if you can follow at 1001 Albums Pod as well, that would be fantastic. Do please review on iTunes if you can. And if you ever want to get in touch with me, the email oasispod@gmail.com is always open. All right. As ever, stay in touch, stay engaged and stay young. Shame.